House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 2nd, 2017, Groundhog Day. And he saw his shadow. Six more weeks of winter. We're going to kind of go out of order and have the two House bills heard first. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2357.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2357 deals with imposing contempt liabilities on non-corporation entities. So right now, the courts have the authority to impose contempt liability on corporations and on employees, high managerial agents, or board of directors who engage in conduct that is subject to contempt. But under the current statute, that is not extended to entities such as limited liability companies. This measure would include those new types of entities. There is no amendment today. It is ready to move if you so choose.
Okay, thank you. Cheryl. Just remember to put your name on the record, please.
Sure. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice, here today in support of House Bill 2357. Brief history lesson, if I may. So in 1993, Oregon passed a law that allowed new types of business entities to come into the state. In 1993, that was the Limited Liability Company, or LLCs, which you've probably heard of. And so with that change, there was a lot of other changes in law. Before LLCs, pretty much the only type of entity in Oregon was the corporation. But like I said, after 1993, that changed. As our lawyers were looking in this particular dusty corner of the law, we noticed that there hadn't been the update to include all those new entities, that this area was just applying to corporations. This particular area of law hadn't been updated since 1991. And like I said, LLCs came into existence in 1993. So in order to just include those new entities that have come along in the 20-some years in between, we requested a bill here just to update that corner of the law. We ran this by any stakeholder we could think of that might be interested, such as, you know, the business folks or anything like that, and they didn't have any feedback to us, no objections. So with that, if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them.
I do.
Representative Olson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So first of all, I guess I don't think that this is right, Cheryl, that you're up here, because I was kind of anticipating that the not individual is going to be up here. Because then that way you could be a little bit more aggressive. I mean, now you're making me feel kind of bad about even asking some questions. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Olson, you'll get him in a minute.
Okay, so, thanks. Yeah. You just kind of closed a little bit that there was no feedback. So kind of tell me, what was your process in reaching out to people, anticipating this was coming, and, you know, who was it you contacted? What was the response, that type of thing?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, we reached out to Associated Oregon Industries and retailers, those kind of folks. Didn't hear anything back. We know they just saw this also as a cleanup to the current statute.
So, follow up. Okay, thanks. The I guess I'm trying to kind of get a grasp on this a little bit. I mean, how big of an expansion is this?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, really it's not much of an expansion at all. What happens here is, in order to go through this process, we have to actually ask the court to do this. So what this is doing is just saying these other entities could be involved in that ask to the court. So it's not actually giving any more, I wouldn't say, power to DOJ or any other person who might want to use this law. It's just merely updating, you know, to include those other entities.
I'll stop right there in case somebody else wants, because I want to chew on it.
I'm a little bit hung up, Cheryl, on the high managerial agent piece and wanting to make sure that we're not creating some ambiguity for who might end up being liable. We talk about the idea that if it's somebody acting within the scope of employment. But then when we define high managerial agent, it's pretty broad. Any officer who exercises authority with respect to formulation of policy, is the word officer there really limited to officers of the entity, or is it anybody who acts like an officer? A bank, for example, may have 1,000 vice presidents, and they're likely to knowingly tolerate something without having any opportunity to actually be directly involved. And so I'm a little bit concerned about that.
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Vile, thank you. So the language we used here is actually just matching what's already been used in other areas of law where we've updated here. So it's pulling definitions that are already in existing law. In other little corners where we've had to update to include LLCs and so forth, they've used this sort of entity language to comport into the bills.
How about that high managerial agent? Is that used anywhere else in the law?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, yeah. So that's in the LLC laws, I believe. And so LLCs have managers, and they have members, and then they have member managers.
And you'll see those listed in mention those here.
Right. And then the high managerial agent would be connected to the corporations or foreign corporations or domestic corporations that are already listed.
Council may be able to help out.
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Vile, it's also being taken from ORS 161.170, which is the criminal liability of corporations, and it's been there for several years.
I saw that, but we took it out, right? We're pulling it out in subsection 4 so that we no longer have that reference to 160-170?
Right, but the Chair Barker, Representative Vile, the definition is the same, so it's just reorganizing that and adding in those new definitions that are coming from other places.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Sorry, Cheryl, that you're going to get sucked into my mission. But I have other questions, and I think Representative Olson may have helped me and understand them, but this is completely separate, but it is part of the bill, and I'm asking this of everybody. What's the emergency? Was that done by LC, or did you request that, or did somebody request that?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, I believe that was done by Legislative Council. And here it's been sitting for quite a while, so we'd want to make sure that any person wanting to bring this action would be able to do so against those other entities. There might be pending cases out there. So.
Okay.
Further. Okay, thank you very much. I've closed the public hearing on House Bill 2357 and open a hearing on House Bill, public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2358. Michael.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. HB 2358 relates to charitable gaming and comes to us from the Department of Justice. The House Bill 2358 raises the allowable prize amount for charitable bingo and lotto games to $5,000 per game. It also increases the number of hours a game may be operated to 20 hours per week and the number of hours a person may work operating the games to 40 hours per week. We do have one amendment. The -1 amendment increases the number of days charitable games may be operated from 3 days a week to 4 days a week. And we do have the fiscal and revenue statements.
Okay, thank you once again. And remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemster. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. Here today in support of House Bill 2358. With me is our attorney in charge of our charitable activities section. This is Elizabeth Grant. DOJ is tasked with enforcing the laws regarding charitable activities and charitable gaming. Quite a while ago, maybe even last summer, we began hearing from the people subject to this law called licensees. We heard from our licensees, and they said, hey, you know what? We haven't done an update in this area of law for quite a while. We had been thinking along the same lines, and so that is the bill before you today. A few small changes just to allow people, the licensees, to operate well in this area for reasons of inflation, just upping the amount from $2,500 to $5,000, and with the gross gaming receipts from 18 to 22%. Also allowing people in working in these areas to up the restriction from 30 to 40 hours, and as just mentioned with the Dash 1 amendment, from the 3 to 4 days. So there's just some small changes that we were able to collaborate with on. I believe there is support from the Nonprofits Association in the committee file today. And with that, again, happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Anybody have any questions? Okay. You want to add anything?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I have nothing to add if there's no questions. I'm Elizabeth Grant, the attorney in charge of the charitable activities section. And I think the bill is fairly self-explanatory, so I have nothing to add unless there's questions.
Okay, great. Any questions? So we need to introduce the
amendment. Dash one amendment.
Okay. I'll accept a motion to include the Dash one amendment.
You can go into a work session?
Yep.
Are you making a motion, Dandy?
We'll open a work session on House Bill 2358.
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Give me a script so I don't screw it up. It's the first time all session. Yeah. Come on. Keep it down here.
And it's the dash ones. Yeah.
All right. Chair Barker, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Chair Williamson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2358. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Seeing none, so ordered. Dash 1's read.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2358 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2358 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Are there any questions or any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. And who would like Carrier? Charitable gambling bill. Representative Springer will be our carrier. Thank you, Representative Springer.
Like a charitable gambling type person.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll open an informational meeting overview of the Oregon Department of Justice. Fred Boss and Aaron Knott, please.
Just Aaron.
Oh, just Aaron. No Fred.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice. Fred Boss expresses his apologies, but he took one look at Representative Olson and said, no way. I'm here to just give you a sort of basic overview of the function of the Department of Justice. I think for some of you, this will be newer than for others. So the Attorney General's powers are housed in Chapter 180 of the ORS. And the basic short form is the Attorney General acts as the manager for the state's law firm. And that takes on a lot of different forms. And I'll sort of go through how some of those work. But it's a broad allocation of authority, though not in Oregon, a constitutional one. Some states have constitutional AGs. We do not. We're purely statutory. So you should have an organizational chart. It's a gripping document. I will move from the left to the right, and I'll keep it on a high level, so if you have questions, I have no doubt you'll follow up with me. First of all, our Criminal Justice Division. The Criminal Justice Division of the Attorney General does not, in most cases, have what I'll call originating jurisdiction. That means we can't just go into any county in the state and assume the role of a district attorney. The legislature has, over the years, given us some special carve-outs for things we can do that are exceptions to that. But generally speaking, most of what the Criminal Justice division does is done on invitation from a district attorney. We can also be invited by the governor, though that power is invoked less frequently. So our DA assist function, counties, particularly small counties, some of these district attorney's offices, if they catch an aggravated murder, okay, they have one, they're all right. If they catch a second one, it pretty much swamps their circuits. And there's no way to know in advance. So the Department of Justice is the sort of pressure valve release for the fact that you never know when these crimes will happen. And I'll point out that while historically aggravated murder has been the most murder and aggravated murder, common charges for which district attorneys have asked for assistance, that has changed over time. What we're finding now are financial crimes are getting much more complicated and using a much larger share. They tend to have very complex discovery, and they often require very specialized expertise. So that's been moving up the list. We also have some investigative functions within our criminal justice unit. One that I think is very important is the Internet Child Crimes Against Children Division. What they do is, so this deals with child pornography. Child pornography on the internet is an incredibly hard thing to find because it has a tendency to move. The websites that house child pornography one day often do not house it the next day. So if somebody bumps into child pornography and says, I think this is on my server, I think I bumped into a website, somebody gave me some sort of a hint. That needs to go to one centralized repository that can do very fast work to figure out if there's a case there, push it out to local law enforcement, and try to preserve that evidence. So we have that function. We also have several resource prosecutors, which is, again, a reflection of our relationship with district attorneys to try to help them with tough, specialized areas. So we have three of those. We have one for domestic violence, one for DUII prosecution, and most recently, and thank you to this body for passing this in 2015, elder abuse. This is another growth area in crime. As the population ages and technology grows more sophisticated, we are seeing a rise in that form of exploitation. Finally, we have a capacity within our criminal justice division to act as a clearinghouse for federal communications. So if the feds want to warn us about an intelligence or other criminal justice sensitive thing that may be happening based on the intelligence that they have gathered, they let us know, and we act as a clearinghouse to push that out to law enforcement. Next up would be our appellate division. Civil, criminal, any state, any case where the state has the predominant interest, if it goes up on appeal, our appellate division represents the argument of the state. So here we're essentially either challenging or attempting to preserve the ruling that was made on the trial court level. We fulfilled this role for district attorneys. So in criminal cases, if there's a conviction and the defense decides to appeal, or for that matter, the state decides to appeal and it goes up, we will brief the Court of Appeals, file the necessary documents, appear. We do the same thing for the Supreme Court. Within this same capacity, we will also defend actions in what is known as post-conviction relief. This basically is when you are alleging that your attorney didn't do a very good job, such a bad job, in fact, that the underlying conviction should be overturned. To give you the extreme example, but it's one that exists, when your attorney sleeps through the trial and you get no assistance, was that competent representation? If you take a plea on the advice of an attorney who is extremely intoxicated, is that competent representation? So we litigate those questions as they go up. Next, our trial division. Our trial division is essentially the defense for the state. The state of Oregon is self-insured. A lot of this goes through DAS via their risk management system. But if Oregon finds themselves the defendant in an action, we represent the state both in terms of trial and in terms of working with DAS to try to resolve that case as the lawyers, and this is our defensive function. We also have an offensive function, which is in our civil enforcement division. So the Attorney General has been tasked with acting as the consumer protection representative for the citizens of the state of Oregon. When I say that we're the attorneys for the state of Oregon, this means different things for different layers. And here, it really does mean the people of the state of Oregon. Now, we can't step into the shoes of a private claimant and say, Aaron Knott has a lawsuit and we're going to file it for Aaron Knott. We need a pattern or practice sufficient enough that we're able to say the behavior of this company is a threat to the people of Oregon more generally. So that's the standard we use. And when that happens, we're able to sort of step into the shoes of those claimants, get them the damages that they deserve, in our view, and try to defend their rights that way. Within our civil enforcement division, which I would broadly, if our trial division is our defense, our civil enforcement would be our offense. There's the general function of protecting Oregon consumers from what we consider to be fraudulent or misleading conduct, generally under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. But we also, as you just heard, we regulate the charitable activities all across the state. Liz Grant didn't talk about that much, but there are many, many of these 501c3s, and we get their tax filings. And we've set up some requirements about how much of that money they actually have to spend on a charitable purpose. You know, we've seen charities go out, and for every dollar that they gather through solicitation, they'll spend 95 cents on themselves, on their bonus, on their advertising. Oregon has a regulatory structure that says that's not permitted, so we help enforce it. Moving down, we represent in our child advocacy function the Department of Human Services in dependency proceedings. We represent their caseworkers there. And we have a specialized Medicaid fraud division here that we engage in partnership with some federal resources to keep Medicaid fraud from happening. Finally, and it's not listed here, I think mostly because we ran out of space, this also houses our civil rights division. That is a hybrid that sits both in the front office of the Attorney General herself, so it's sort of a cabinet level position for her, but then also has a litigation function within the civil enforcement division, predominantly, though not exclusively, focused on fair housing litigation. So moving to crime victim services.
Can I stop you, Aaron?
Of course.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
Sure. Why is it only focused on housing, or primarily focused on housing?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, the answer to that isn't simple, and it has to do with the lack of accord between what we would think of, I think, a lot of the civil rights definitions that we tend to rely on when engaging in litigation don't come from state law. A lot of it is federal. In the state, we have to rely on different causes of action that we would sort of bring under the banner of what is known more colloquially as civil rights. For example, if you're deprived of your housing without process, fair housing, recognized as coming under that umbrella. But the terms in state law that we rely on, they don't come under anything like a Civil Rights Act. They're scattered all over the ORSs. So I think that goes some way to explain why there's not a discrete civil rights statute that we can look at. Did that answer the question okay?
How is this linked with Boley? I think that's a piece of it. I know they have a piece of the action as well.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, Boley has an administrative process for resolving fair housing cases that you sort of have to exhaust before you can go into a civil remedy where DOJ would come over because you need a lawyer to represent those claims. So the Boley portion would be if you have somebody who's alleging a problem with fair housing, they make a complaint to Boley and they think that complaint is colorable, there's an administrative process that Boley hosts. If that administrative process doesn't resolve the fair housing complaint, the complainant has the option to opt in to circuit court, at which point DOJ would get involved.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on then to our Crime Victim Services Division. So this division, which is definitely an Oregon-specific institution and a very good one, exists to support victims generally. So in many respects, we're a pass-through. We support the District Attorney's Victims Assistance Programs, we support domestic violence shelters, and we also support in direct monetary ways crime victims themselves via our crime victim compensation package. If you are a crime victim who's seriously injured, you know, you're in a hit and run, you're assaulted, and this is not low-level stuff. You're looking at injuries that are going to require real rehabilitation. You can petition to the Crime Victim Services Division for compensation so you don't have to wait for restitution, insurance, or some other form of compensation that may never come around. We pay for a lot of other good things with this fund. We pay for the domestic violence resource prosecutor that I mentioned earlier, the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, and other key services for victims when they're in a time of need.
We have a question.
I have a question about the overall crime victims services. So,
well, the only other thing I would note there is those funds are paid for largely through punitive damages, which has become an increasingly unreliable form of award over the years for a number of reasons I could go into. But the punchline is that our ability to adequately compensate crime victims and prop up these services has been a legislative issue for as long as I have been around, and I think it will continue to be so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron, how much federal money comes into that, to crime victim services in Oregon, in your agency, do you know?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, that information is readily available, and I would be happy to distribute it to the entirety of the community. I will tell you that it is significant enough that if anything was to happen to it, we would be in a very difficult position.
Thank you.
So can I just follow up?
Sure.
So is there a match with that, Aaron? Do you know? Or is there something that we have to be doing to work toward crime victims ourselves with statutes in order to receive that?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I think the right person to walk you through that would be Shannon Savell, the Director of Crime Victim Services Division. My much more basic understanding is that there are some state general fund dollars that are allocated both to crime victims compensation, which, as I mentioned before, has at times been insolvent because not enough punitive money was coming in, and for some other administrative function. But a significant component of what keeps our shelters open and our DA advocates working comes from the federal government.
Aaron, can you have Shannon, when she puts that together for you, list the sources? I'm particularly interested in the Violence Against Women Act funding and where that goes.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, we could distribute that to the entirety
of this committee.
Okay, I'll move on. Next, our General Counsel Division. Everyone from the Department of Human Services all the way down to the Blueberry Commission has, to some extent, a General Counsel available appointed by the state. All boards, all commissions, all state agencies. And again, state, this isn't county, this isn't city. If you're not a state agency, you're not our client. So our General Counsel Division provides legal advice to these agencies on everything you could imagine. It's basically the same function you would get from a law firm if you retained the law firm, if the Department of Human Services contracted with a law firm. So with the exception of if it goes to trial, it will go to our trial division. But everything short of that, looking over policy, vetting contracts, looking at administrative rules, getting guidance on those issues, comes from our General Counsel Division. The opinions that are issued by the Attorney General's office, which you will probably bump into at one point or another, are also generally issued by that division, though that can depend somewhat in if the subject matter is exceptional. I'll note here that as the legislators for the state of Oregon, you too have the ability to pursue legal advice in the form of a DOJ opinion. Of course, we normally bill for this service to whoever the requester is, so I can't tell you it will be uncompensated, but it is an ability that you have, and there are times where that can be useful, particularly when the legal question you want answered is very strongly one that implicates administrative law or agency politics.
Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlee.
Somebody on
it. Oh, Representative.
Oh, yeah, Representative Greenlee. You want me to go ahead? Okay. I'm curious about that billing process. I understand that every agency that asks for DOJ's help with anything gets a bill. How do the agencies budget for that, and how does DOJ budget for its staff, given the fact that you don't know how much work may or may not come from those agencies?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, that is a very good question. The model we use now is a billable model that was affixed in statute and is modified session to session by the legislature. That budget is just like any other budget insofar as it's within the purview of this branch. So agencies will have a sense of how much money they have, and we just try to manage it responsibly. You are absolutely correct that legal expenses can be volatile, that you don't always know when something will happen that will expose you to suit, and those numbers could go up or down, but it's handled just like any other budgetary process. It goes through ways and means. If agencies or DOJ find themselves confronted with unexpected expenses, the remedy is usually to go to the e-board.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
And just out of curiosity, what are the DOJ rates to an agency compared to, for example, private law firm rates?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, while I don't have an exact comparison, they're low. Our services are subsidized to some extent by the process that we use with the legislature, and we're not trying to compete in any sort of an open market. Now, I will make the comment that how much you pay for an attorney in the open market, for us, it's a standard billing rate. We diversify it across all agencies, and that's partially about smoothing out those ups and downs as well. If you were in the private market, if you wanted to engage in securities litigation as opposed to having a will drawn up, the expense would be drastically different, even on a per-hour basis. So it's hard to make a one-to-one comparison.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. This isn't the first time you've heard me ask this question. I think where you started was the Attorney General manages a law firm for the state of Oregon, by which I think that means the people of the state of Oregon. Would you agree with that?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I would, with the caveat that we are unable to represent individuals. At that point, we'd have a conflict.
But basically, you're representing the people. When you get into the job of providing legal advice to boards and agencies, especially boards, it's been my experience that sometimes boards have specialized interests in their legal opinions against the interests of some of the people of the state of Oregon. In a private law firm, I think you'd find that to be a conflict of interest and wouldn't be able to serve both those kind of functions. How do you manage to assure that the attorneys representing the Board of Psychology, for example, or the Board of Psychology Examiners for another short time, you're representing them against a client that they have, you're giving advice about how to deal with that individual, that sometimes seems like if you were the lawyer for the state, for the people, it would be a very different circumstance. You have, it seems to me, a conflict of interest. How do you mediate that with your attorneys who work for boards and agencies?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I think the most basic function of an attorney in that disposition is going to be to try to help the Border Commission follow the law, that they accurately understand what their obligations are under statute and under administrative rule. The attorney, as long as what's being proposed, I think what you're asking is if there was a policy objection, a feeling that the board was doing something that from a policy perspective someone might feel was bad for the state of Oregon, what would the attorney do? As differentiated from if the board was proposing a violation of law, if they were saying we're going to not follow a statute or not follow administrative rule, which I think is a different question. Our attorneys typically don't tell the boards or commissions what to do from a policy perspective. That's still, I don't think they view that as their role. So it would be a question of whether they're following the law.
If I may follow up.
Follow up, please.
Well, sometimes these things go to administrative law judges to determine when there's a argument between a professional and their board. It seems to me how they get into that kind of a process as opposed to dealing with it administratively as a board decision is frequently on the advice of their legal counsel. They're in essentially a pseudo litigation situation. It seems they're not necessarily representing the individuals of the state of Oregon in that circumstance.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, every general counsel attorney bears to some extent an attorney-client, actually with strong extent, an attorney-client relationship within the individual agency.
Exactly.
And so their job, I agree, is to sort of work with that client to effectuate that client's purpose under the auspices of that client, and that agency, that commission, extends in some way from the decisions that were made in a democratic way from this body and the governor elsewhere in the executive branch. So it does all sort of come back to a state of Oregon-driven democratic process. I will say that on those occasions where agencies, boards, commissions engage in behavior that rises to the level of being questionable, we do have a capacity within the Department of Justice to sort of silo those issues and do an investigation. It's happened multiple times, sometimes under the auspices of official misconduct, sometimes not. But again, those are going to be examples where a board or commission has gone so far as to, in the legal opinion of the Department of Justice, actually violate the law or in some other way exceed what is permissible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Where was I? Child support. So our child support division processes, and for those of you who hold office, this is probably the one that's going to generate the most constituent interest for you. So just so we're, and pass this to your colleagues, when you receive a constituent complaint on either direction, whether the person who owes or the person who is being paid or somebody else who is involved, from a constituent about a child support issue, we are here to help. If you contact us, we will do our best to shepherd you through the process. We have dedicated resources for that because that issue receives so much attention. We estimate we process a little over $1 million a day in child support across the state. It uses, I think, something like 50% of the total personnel of the Department of Justice. We have offices all over the state for this purpose. Finally, last thing is just the basic administrative functions of the Attorney General's office. There's the usual quasi-DAS infrastructure for administration, and then a very small office within the office of the Attorney General herself, which includes the Deputy District Attorney, a special counsel, an elder abuse consumer protection expert, myself, Cheryl, who you met, the Civil Rights Director, and some administrative staff. So that's your overview. I'm happy to answer any questions we have not already gotten to.
I'm sorry that you get to be the beneficiary of this, but I've been waiting for this one, Aaron. I'm going to read to you a quote that was recorded by a constituent of mine just in the last 3 weeks. And the background on this is that DOJ had garnished, in spite of the fact that there was a court order that had said no garnishment in this particular case because of some extenuating circumstances. And the DOJ response was, quote, "We initiate withholding all the time with no good cause in violation of court orders. We just don't have the manpower or the processes to obey our own rules." Now, that's a recorded message that came back to the constituent. I know that it's huge, and I know that it's a big, big operation that you're trying to run, and sometimes not all the gears in a mill mesh exactly like they should. But that troubled me that that would be the statement of a, in this case, DOJ employee saying, shucks, we can't catch, okay, you got a court order, but we can't really take the time to make sure we've obeyed all those court orders. We're just processing this in a routine fashion. Could you make a comment on that for me, please?
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Vile, with the leave of the chair, could I ask a question at the questioner? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vile, again, so this is, contextually, this would be a garnishment on a child support action?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Barker, Representative Vile, I have no direct knowledge of this and would want to know a lot more about it. I think this is a hard question for me to ask without or answer without any real context about where that quote came. What little I know of garnishment orders, they're typically that. They're orders, meaning they are in fact filed by the court, and I'd have to take a look at our ability to do a ex parte garnishment without any sort of court action. So I would be happy to follow up with your office, and I'll give you a commitment now that if we have that meeting, I will run down whatever this is, and we will talk about it as long as we need to. But without being able to look at a file or knowing who is involved, that's all I can offer.
Just look me in the eye and tell me that the process is not so broken that folks are feeling at the staff level like they're so overwhelmed that they just can't take the time to deal with maybe those odd cases that have an order that maybe doesn't look like 600 other orders that they've done that same day.
Representative Barker, Representative Vile, every public agency of which I am aware is to some extent groaning under the weight of underfunding, particularly in public safety. That being said, I have never gotten a complaint of this kind in the entirety of the time I've worked at the Oregon Department of Justice. This is the first time I've ever heard this complaint made. I think people are under a lot of work, but I've never heard that used as a justification for a failure to follow the law.
And I'll just follow up with this. I appreciate very much the fact that these folks are trying hard and that funding is an issue. I know that in the private sector, oftentimes our collection actions, the deadbeat, the ne'er-do-well, ends up paying the costs of collections on top of the collection of the funds that were due itself. And I don't know if there are some structural changes that might be looked at to make sure that the resources weren't groaning such that folks who maybe didn't need to be ended up getting hurt by some of these situations. And I will follow up with you with the specifics on this one.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
I have a couple, Aaron. On it seems to me the Attorney General one time said if you're getting these calls from the computer repair to let DOJ know. The latest thing I've been getting is somebody in New Jersey is calling and they're saying your Apple cloud has been compromised and you don't use your until you call us. Of course, I hang up. Don't call them. But
Microsoft too.
Chair Barker,
almost that it's probably originating out of
Middle East. Chair Barker, that's actually a very good question. We for that particular scam, we have two real ways of keeping tabs on what's going on with this. One is we have a very large consumer database of complaints that comes in. We have a hotline, and that's actually how we establish pattern or practice. The other main method was Colleen Krieger, but with her no longer in the building, she was very good at letting us know what she was hearing in her community. But that makes a larger, and I'm not entirely joking, point. When you hear about scams from your constituents, it's really important that you let us know. We are able to issue scam alerts statewide. They have a very wide readership, and they tend to trickle down to the local level. So that one is a perfect example. This is a common scam right now. People call you up. They claim you're on the cloud. They can tell that your computer isn't working, and they have to get into your computer and fix it. And then they do, in fact, get into your computer, and they pull out all your personal information. So keep those complaints coming. That's a very good question. We're always happy to hear them.
Okay, and then the other thing, on the charitable groups where you are able to put out the information that 40% is going to the operators, I recently heard, I think it was on NPR program, so a tech CEO gives up his tech and he decides to fundraise for a charitable thing. And people in his bracket would make $600,000 a year. So he gets some of his fellow young up-and-comers, and they pay them about $400,000 a year to raise money for this charity. They raise so much more money, it's phenomenal, but because the ratio looks funny, the donations stopped coming in once that was reported, although they actually were really serving that community. So when you look at those ratios, you look at the amounts that were brought in. For example, because I mean, it would seem to me that these guys really were doing a great job, even though they were getting paid.
Chair Barker, the person that could answer that question, which is a very technical question within our charitable activities division, is in the room if you want to answer it. I am not familiar enough with that area of law to answer.
Okay, well, I can check offline on that. But it was an interesting concept I hadn't thought about because I do this. I think what many donors do when you see that. The Wounded Warrior Project, all the money's going to the guy who's, right. You know, you quit donating or don't donate. Okay, is there, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barker. And my apologies for being about 20 minutes behind in my question. And this question might be a better topic for Public Safety Subcommittee. You referenced the Punitive Damages Fund for crime victim services. And that's you know, highly unpredictable and therefore can be affected. Looking at the numbers of that, you know, what Oregon puts in versus the federal punitive damages grants that we receive, you know, Oregon's is only about 2%, maybe 3% of that. So how do we actually see that play out where it affects the services, and how do we actually predict as to what we expect to come in through those federal grants and through Oregon? Because the way you made the statement made it seem as though those services are at risk because these funds are unpredictable. When I look at $2.6 million from Oregon and $19 million from the feds on the grants, that seems like a small percentage of the overall budget for crime services. So I'm trying to link all that together. Maybe you can clarify for me a little.
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, I'll give it a try, though. I'm not the budget. You'll be hearing from someone else when we're down in the pub sub. So the money that comes from the feds in the form of grants is pretty predictable in the sense that it's part of a congressional allocation. You know, it moves over time. It's actually gone up for the most part, not drastically, but it goes up over time. So it's that portion is an allocation that's made by a decision of the federal government. So it's not pegged to their punitive damages award or whatever they have coming in and out. It's pegged to the federal budget. The Oregon punitive damages really is just Oregon punitive damages. It's when we are involved in litigation as a state. Sometimes when we win, the jury will impose a punitive damage. And that's really when it happens, is a jury imposes a punitive damage. So if a case settles or is in some other way resolved, punitive damages usually don't enter into it. So one of the reasons that punitives are becoming scarcer is because, you know, the threat of being hit with punitive damages is ironically enough to keep you from putting yourself in a position where punitive damages would happen. So we've seen a slowing of that over time that I think reflects in part a change in sort of how cases are being disposed of in the larger legal community. So that will always be volatile because in order for us to get that money, we have to win and there have to be punitives. Those cases don't come around every day.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair. So when we look at the, you know, the total amount of money that we're looking at for crime victim services, and we have $2.6 million that's volatile because they're connected to Oregon punitive damages, what services end up at risk with that? I mean, I'm trying to make the final connecting point of, you know, being afraid or finding a different source and so forth about these if they're really a small portion of our overall budget in that sector and how what it's really affecting.
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, here's my understanding of how that works. So the grants that come down from the feds have a designated purpose. You have VOCA grants, VAWA grants. Those are normally pass-throughs. So we'll fund domestic violence shelters, we'll fund district attorney victim assistance people. Punitive damages is the Crime Victims Compensation Fund, which we pay the administration of CVSD out of those. That's not a pass-through. That actually sticks to us. But then it's also used for something like the Sexual Assault Task Force, the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor, but then also those payments that are going out to crime victims. So the VOCA VAWA grants, those sort of set up your structures, your shelters, your advocates. But the actual, if you're involved in a serious crime and you're seriously injured or killed and you need funereal expenses, you need counseling, that comes out of crime victims compensation. So when the feds give us the money, they don't say, here's a VAWA grant, you can spend it however you want within the administration of crime victim services. So even though it is a smaller portion of the whole, it does affect the core function of crime victim services. And we will talk about this more.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is it commission hearing? And then overview of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Michael Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and happy to give you an overview. Thank you for having me here and inviting me. I've prepared a PowerPoint presentation, so it's kind of hard to see. So for those of you with laptops in front of you, it might be easier to pull it up because the font gets kind of small up here. But I gave this presentation this morning to Senate Judiciary. It seemed to work well with going with questions as they come up, so feel free to jump in. I know Representative Olson told me yesterday he's already got 30 questions for me, which seemed excessive at the time. I just want to kind of give you a little bit of the history of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Doing a little bit of research, back to 1983 was where I saw the earliest iteration of what is now known as the CJC, the Criminal Justice Commission, and it started as the Oregon Prison Overcrowding Project. Which was established to look at the state's prison system and overcrowding issues that they were facing at that time. and to come up with strategies for relieving that. That turned into the Oregon Criminal Justice Council in 1985, which continued to study capacity issues of the Oregon State Prison System and make suggestions to the legislature and the governor's office. In 1989, Oregon went from an indeterminate sentencing system to a determinate sentencing system. And what that means, indeterminate, was when you were in the courtroom and being sentenced for a crime, a judge would say, okay, you're sentenced for 10 years of prison. And it was 10 years no matter what, always 10 years. But you'd be paroled at some point between 0 and 10 years. That was indeterminate because in the courtroom it wasn't specific what your sentence would be. Oregon in 1989 adopted the sentencing guidelines, and that made us a determinate system, wherein the judge in the courtroom would actually give a specific number for what your sentence would be. So within the 0 to 10 range, they'd say your sentence is 70 months. That's the system that we have today. And the Criminal Justice Commission got its start as a sentencing commission. And so one of the very first things when looking at the history of why we were doing this is we looked at the resources the state had. We looked at all the different types of crimes and then made some decisions on sentence length based on parity of different types and then also criminal history. And that's where we have today the sentencing guidelines grid, which I'll show you in a second for those of you who haven't seen it. Going forward from the sentencing guidelines, the Criminal Justice Commission the Criminal Justice Council sunset in 1995 and was reconstituted as the commission. In 2005, we started administering grants, and that actually takes up a lot of the work that we do today. We started with drug courts, specialty court grants, which we still have a very robust specialty court program today. And then in 2013, some of you at this table were involved with the passage of House Bill 3194, the Justice Reinvestment Act, which represents our biggest grant policy or our biggest grant pot to date. So that's kind of just a high-level history. This is the current makeup of our commission. So unfortunately, Representative Olson had to leave us. He was termed out, but we gained Representative Stark. So happy to have him along. But you'll see that we have good geographic distribution.
Unfair trade act there.
Fair trade.
Unfair trade. Sorry.
I'm a little confused with that comment there, Mr. Chair.
So we have good geographic diversity of members and then also different public safety folks. So we have community corrections, district attorney, and other folks who touch the criminal justice system in different ways. This is our statutory mandates. We kind of bullet pointed it out here, but our mission is to improve the efficiency and effectiveness. That kind of stems from our sentencing guidelines mission that we were started out with. And these bullets represent all the different things that we do that make up our work. We are to be the centralized and impartial forum for policy development and planning. Develop a long-range public safety policy. Right now in Oregon, that long-range plan is the Justice Reinvestment Act. Analyzing capacity and use of state prisons. I'll show you some dashboards as we get through here that look at how counties use prison and how statewide we use prison. And so we do a lot of work with Oregon's data and statistics. We do the drug courts. Like I said, we do research. Currently, right now, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission has four different studies underway, two of which are randomized controlled trials. So a lot of our work and effort goes to doing research. We do fiscal impacts. We do racial and ethnic impacts upon request. Data, guidelines, and then we participate in a lot of different task force and kind of an advisory function. So we got a lot of things. There are 11 staff at the Criminal Justice Commission.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Yes.
Do you deal with the forensic use of the state hospital as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, we have been invited by OHA into some of those conversations as they talk with the counties, but we have not taken on that issue specifically. OHA has been leading those conversations.
If I can follow up.
Follow up, please.
There's a big problem with state hospitals, as I'm sure you know, with the 370 population, the 86 population. Any help we can get to deal with that problem would be very, very welcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, absolutely. We will continue to work with OHA. I'm hopeful that our work with the local public safety coordinating councils in the counties can be that place where we can have that dialogue with county folks and then the state folks to come up with solutions. And so we very much support and provide technical assistance to those LIPSICs.
Great.
But we'll continue to do so.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
So here's the guidelines. If you haven't seen this before, you know, I'm happy to come in and help you walk you through it. I remember when I was a deputy district attorney and made the jump from misdemeanors to felonies, because misdemeanors, you don't use the sentencing guideline grid. And, you know, even though I had been a deputy for a couple years at that point, it is kind of a lot to take in. And if you actually had it in front of you, the font is so small that, you know, you really need to have your own magnifying glass. But it encompasses all of our felony sentencing laws on one front and back piece of paper. And so what you see here is you have all of Oregon's crime severity is ranked on the left from 1 to 11, 1 being the least serious crime ranking, which in Oregon is possession of a controlled substance is a level 1 crime, the least serious crime you can commit as a felony, all the way up to aggravated murder and all the way up to the top. So that's the crime severity, 1 to 11. Then on the top there, you have the A through I. That represents your criminal history. The folks with the absolute worst criminal histories are your A's, people who have never had any kind of entry into the criminal justice system, any convictions before. Those are your I's. And so when you have a case in front of you, you essentially look at the crime severity and the criminal history, and you bring your two fingers together, and that is the presumptive sentence that the court will impose. And so anything you see up there in yellow above the dark black line, that's a prison sentence. Anything below the dark black line is a probation sentence. So when you hear about attorneys talking about presumptive sentences or downward departures, downward departure just means that you're going from above the black line to below the black line. You're going from a prison sentence to a probation sentence. Upward departure, inverse. So happy, like I said, when I first saw it, it's a lot to take in. And if anyone's interested, I'd be happy to sit down with you and walk you through understanding the document. But that's what we do. Our commissioners, every year the legislature gets together, passes laws. So long as the legislature does not itself rank the crime severity, which is happening more and more, where it's left to the Criminal Justice Commission, our commissioners get together and we have a discussion and debate, and then they propose what the crime severity should be, and then I bring it back in front of you all to approve the rule adoption. So that's how that process works. So. The sentencing guidelines is kind of how we got our start as a sentencing commission, but the real work, the day-to-day of what we do, is kind of represented in this Mastercardian Venn diagram. Grants and research. That's pretty much how we spend all of our time. And so we have the justice reinvestment grants and specialty courts, and on the other side, we're doing actual research to see if some of these things are working. So I'll just kind of walk through in more detail. This biennium, our grants, we had $38.7 million go to the counties in the justice reinvestment grants. That's up from $15 million in the 13-15 biennium. All 36 counties are justice reinvestment grant recipients. Every county participates in that program. The minimum that you can be awarded is $100,000. Anything above that is based on a formula based on how many, the DOC formula of felony offenders in your community that are on supervision. So $38.7 million, 10% of that goes to nonprofit community-based victim services. 3% of that goes to research, to actually funding some of the studies that we're working on to see if the things that we are trying are working. And then the remainder goes to the LIPSICs in every county to determine how best to invest to improve their local public safety system. So it's not determined by the state the things that they are going to do, but it is guided by four different goals. Those four goals are to decrease prison usage, to decrease recidivism rates in the county, to increase public safety, which kind of go hand in hand, and to hold offenders accountable. So that's broadly what the Justice Reinvestment Grants go for. Our specialty court grants in this past biennium is a mixture of general fund and federal funds. It's about $10 million, I believe, in general fund and about $4 million or so in federal funds. We use a lot of our federal burn JAG grant to fund the specialty courts. And the way we do that is because we are the designated SAA for the state administering agency. So what is Justice Reinvestment? For those of you who are maybe a little bit newer or not sure, it was passed in 2013, House Bill 3194. And again, kind of going back to the history of the Criminal Justice Commission, the state of Oregon was at a point where we were looking at needing to build a new prison based on prison forecasts. And so what these two charts show is where we would have been if where the forecast was in 2013, where we were projected to go, and that's represented by the green line. So that's the 2013 April prison forecast. And what that called for was that Oregon would need to have, in the year 2017, a operational, up-and-running prison facility to accommodate the growth that was being projected. So members of this body got together and thought that there could be a better way to do that, where we could both increase public safety but avoid having to spend all that money to build a new prison. And so what you see in the black line is the departure from where we were going before that legislation was passed to where we actually have gone. So to date, the needing to build an additional prison facility is out of the 10-year horizon. It's beyond 2023. We are not planning on having to build that facility. That being said, when Justice Reinvestment was being negotiated, they weren't looking discreetly at the male and female populations. They were looking at it as all one big prison population. But in reality, all the female offenders are housed in one facility in Coffee Creek, and that facility is at and has been at for the past year its maximum capacity. So more recently, we've been focusing, and the counties have been focusing their grant programs on looking at ways that they can, within the bounds of public safety, put resources, especially towards programs that might be helpful for keeping women supervised locally as opposed to being sent to the prison. So that is one way, and I'm very hopeful that when the next prison forecast comes out in April, we will not be looking at having to open up an additional facility to house women. But currently the plan would be OSPM to open that up. So so far we've avoided having to open prisons based on the work that the counties have done in Justice Reinvestment, the grant programs, and some modest sentencing changes, the biggest of which was short-term transitional leave, which essentially means you spend the last 90 days of your prison sentence in the county as opposed to in prison. And so that was the biggest statutory change in Bedsaver that was passed in House Bill 3194. The CJC, what we do in terms of Justice Reinvestment, we are kind of the clearinghouse of information. So since the passage of this legislation, we've been getting counties together. Obviously, we administer the grants, but we get the counties together and give them information and let them know how they're using prison, how they compare to their sister counties, how they compare to themselves historically, whether they're up or down. We particularly focus on property and drug crimes. We're not focused on, person or sex offender type crimes. We really are looking at giving counties resources they need with the grants to supervise those property and drug offenders locally instead of sending them to prison. So we get together quarterly in convenings, and the counties all send people from their LIPSICs, and we walk through the data, and we show them exactly how they use this resource, how it compares, and we cut it a million different ways. We look at average prison length. We look at number of inmates per capita, and we compare those things. And like I said, and I was talking to Representative Stark before this started, we look at the counties' past and previous practices of using prison, and are they increasing? Are they going up, or are they decreasing? Are they going down? So we compare counties to themselves. And the LIPSIX and the ORS is 423-560 is the body that determines how those funds are spent. So we spend a lot of time working with LIPSIX in the counties, and we pride ourselves on getting out of Salem and actually going into the counties and meeting with these folks. So, you know, if you attend any of your local public safety coordinating council meetings, I'm sure at some point you would have come across someone from CJC who was there to answer questions or give data or advice. Our specialty courts program is our other big grant. We currently fund 38 courts across the state, the bulk of which, the majority, are adult drug courts. But we also have a veterans court. We have a DUI court. We have several mental health courts. We have some family juvenile courts. So it is kind of a mixed bag of specialty courts. But we, you know, a lot of counties have a CJC grant. That's about represents a little bit more than half of all the specialty courts in the state are funded through the Criminal Justice Commission. And then, like I said, research. Research takes up the other half of our time. And so this is Kelly Officer from my staff. If you know Kelly, she's fantastic. If you ask us data questions, it's probably Kelly answering your question. We won two awards this summer, two national awards for work that Kelly and her team did. So we were really excited about that. In fact, we swept the small state awards at the national convention. So we were very proud. so that was great, great for us. And like I said, we have four different studies in progress. We're studying the 416 program right now, which runs in Lane, Marion counties, and also Klamath County. We're looking at housing and whether or not just having housing reduces recidivism. So we have that study going on in Polk, Baker, and Umatilla counties. Looking at reentry supervision in Linn County and I believe Douglas County. And then looking at pretrial assessments or risk assessments that go to decision makers when they're looking at sentences. And we're working with Josephine, Yamhill, and Union counties. So we really try to get across and around the state to get a good look at our entire system. And so we're excited about those. The thing about studies, especially randomized controlled trials, is they take a lot of time. And so some of these studies won't be done for probably about 5 years. But so in the last year, the big innovation at the CJC has been our interactive data dashboards. So if you've spent any time on our website, there's a button for interactive data dashboards. It'll take you to this page, and this is a screenshot of that page. And what it does is it allows anybody 24/7 to go on our website and start asking some of these questions for themselves. You can look at prison usage by county. You can look at crime types, convictions by county. You can sort it statewide. You can look at race and ethnicity. So we're trying to put the data out there for people to make decisions and being able to make data-informed decisions locally as they make those public safety questions that they have to tackle. We have recidivism data on there, so you can look at recidivism rates across counties and across the state. Our Justice Reinvestment Grant Program, if you wanted to know exactly how your county spent their grant dollars, you can go onto that dashboard and click on your county and find out exactly how they spent that money so that you could evaluate how you think that's going. So we're just trying to get as much of this out there transparently, allow people to, like I said, use data to make decisions. I highly encourage you to check it out. It's pretty cool. And the other big thing that we've done in the past year is a project that we worked on with DPSST called the Oregon Knowledge Bank. The Oregon Knowledge Bank is another kind of first in the nation resource. And the idea was to connect public safety people in Oregon with each other, because we're all in all of our communities, we're facing similar issues, right? Whether it's local bike thefts or homeless problems or whatever it is, all these jurisdictions have similar issues, and they have a lot of different ways of tackling it. So we developed the knowledge bank so that they could actually share information, and you could go on there and look and see exactly what is working in a local community and then who the person to contact would be, so you can ask them questions if you wanted to try to imitate what the work that they're doing. So it's all about sharing information. This resource right now is
dollars directed at police officers and at corrections officers and community corrections. So sharing programs and information about how they do their job to tackle the problems that they face. It also is a place where you can go to get Oregon-specific research on criminal justice issues. So instead of going to Google or someplace else, you can actually go here and see all the studies that have been done in Oregon. So you're not looking at a study that was done by the NYPD or LAPD and, you know, trying to extrapolate whether or not that's going to work in Springfield. Right? You can actually go into here and see, has anything been like this studied in Oregon? And so we're constantly adding to both of these things and trying to get people to know that they're there because the more they're used, the better the resources become. And then finally is a plug for the Justice Reinvestment Summit, February 16th and 17th. I hope you all will be there. I think you'll be, or this committee is going to be there at least on Friday. So that's fantastic. To date, we have over 800 different Oregonians registered to attend, all from different walks of public safety. We're at the point now where we think we actually are going to have to close the event as being sold out, even though it's a free event. But we have booked all the hotels in Salem, and I think we've run out of tables in the convention center. So we're incredibly excited for that. We've got speakers from all over the country talking about the different ways that they've approached both justice reinvestment and then other public safety issues that we hope are very relevant to all the different stakeholders that we have coming. We've tried very hard to kind of have something for everybody there. So I hope you can join us. I think it's going to be a really great event.
Thank you. Could you share with us the nature of some of those randomized clinical trials that we have going here in Oregon?
Sure. So Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the housing study that we're still in the process of setting that up, but it's really trying to isolate housing as the one variable that's different. So they've set up a control group, and the way that they're setting up the control is because there's a natural lack of resources, so not everybody gets housing anyway. So essentially, they are randomizing the people who are receiving the resource and are not, and then we're going to study and see if that one intervention makes a difference in recidivism over a 3-year period of time.
How large a population will you be dealing with?
Pardon me, sir.
How large a population will you be dealing with?
How many people?
What's the size of the sample?
Well, we have, I think, 3 different counties participating, and we're trying to get over 100 in each group, I believe. I can get you more specific details, but I'm pretty sure that's what we were shooting for, to have over 200 people in the study all together, bringing all the counties together.
That sample size will be big enough to check an effect.
That is, that is the design. So the housing is one. We are doing the randomized control trial on the 416 program, which is Marion County, Lane County, and Klamath County's diversion to probation for property offenders who would otherwise be going to prison. And it's a high-intensity supervision program. And so, again, setting up a control group where and in that one, it's not comparing the control group of prison to the program. It's comparing regular probation versus the high-intensity supervision probation that the 416 program offers, because it wouldn't be ethical to, study
usual
whether or not.
Care.
Sorry.
It'll be usual care compared with the intervention.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So we're, so in those 3 counties, again, we're getting together enough of a sample size, and that's a much larger sample size than the housing study that we're able to get to look at whether or not that intensive supervision is more effective.
The outcome measures recidivism?
That's correct.
That's really nice that we're doing that kind of stuff.
Thank you, sir.
Anything further? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Remind folks that we're not going to do this.
Yeah, the EPSST trip has been canceled due to the wimpiness of Kevin Campbell and Floyd Prozansky.
Is that official?
That is official.
Good.
We're done. Committee's adjourned. Thank you, committee. committee's adjourned. Thank you, committee.